MyAudiobooks.ai presents The 11th Juror, the note that stopped the Lindsey Clancy trial. On September 3rd, 2026, after 6 days of deliberation in the first Lindsey Clancy trial, the jury foreperson sent a note out of the deliberation room, and the note did something no evidence in 5 weeks had managed to do. It stopped the trial cold. The note, as it was later characterized in open court by defense counsel, and this article will be careful throughout about that characterization, reported that one juror had made statements acknowledging doubt, but refused to apply it to the verdict, as the law states. Read that sentence the way a trial judge has to read it. A juror who admits there is doubt and will not act on the doubt. If that is what the juror means, the juror is not deliberating. The juror is refusing the legal standard itself. And a judge who learns that has a problem with no good solution, because every tool for fixing it requires reaching into the one room in American law that no one is allowed to enter. This is the second of two articles about Commonwealth versus Lindsey Clancy. The first examined the question the jury was asked, whether the Commonwealth had proved criminal responsibility beyond a reasonable doubt, under the Massachusetts substantial capacity test. This article is about what happened when 12 people tried to answer it. 8 days, from the August 27th charge to the September 4th mistrial, in which a murder trial became a constitutional dead end that every participant navigated correctly and which ended with no verdict, no reviewable error, no removable juror, and no lawful path to 12. It is the rare legal story in which everyone follows the rules and the rules still fail. And it raises the question of whether that failure is a malfunction of the jury system or the price of having one. The source note from the first article applies here with doubled force. Everything quoted comes from public recording-derived transcriptions of the post-trial hearings, the September 3rd and 4th proceedings, and the emergency appellate hearing, and from the trial transcripts. These are not certified court reporter transcripts. The jury notes themselves were not read into the record verbatim. What exists in the public record is the judges' and the lawyers' characterizations of the notes in open court. This article quotes those characterizations and identifies them as such. Where the direction of the final vote split is concerned, the public record attributes it to the foreperson's note and counsel's arguments. It is not a verdict, and nothing here treats it as one. At myaudiobooks.ai, you can create your own audiobooks from prompts, turn your documents into audio, all with one subscription, and store your items in your own personal library. The chronology matters, and it is short enough to hold in one view. August 27th, Judge Sullivan delivers the substantial capacity charge, the instruction analyzed in the first article, and the jury retires. September 1st, the first report of deadlock. The court does not treat it as a formal deadlock. No re-instruction, no pressure, just a return to deliberations. That sequencing will matter later. September 2nd, a renewed deadlock report. And this time, the judge gives the standard re-instruction used in Massachusetts for deadlocked juries, the charge known from the cases Toohey and Rodriguez, a carefully balanced reminder that encourages agreement without coercing it, telling jurors to listen to one another with courtesy and respect, but to surrender their view only if they are honestly persuaded. September 3rd, the note. And September 4th, the day the trial's machinery met the note's implications, in a hearing that ran through argument, a bench ruling, a final re-instruction, one more jury note, and the declaration of a mistrial, while in a separate courtroom, the state's highest court considered an emergency petition to intervene before the mistrial could happen. To understand why the September 3rd note created a crisis rather than a routine deadlock, it helps to understand what the law forbids. The deliberation room is a black box by design. Jurors may not be questioned about their deliberations. Verdicts may not be investigated. The reasoning of a jury is constitutionally insulated from review because the alternative, judges auditing how juries think, would be worse than any deadlock. Into this absolute rule, the courts have carved one narrow exception. And in Massachusetts, the exception has a case name, Commonwealth versus Raunchy, decided by the Supreme Judicial Court in 2023. When reliable information suggests a juror's impartiality, bias, exposure to outside influence, or inability to deliberate, a judge may, sometimes must, conduct an individual examination of that juror, a voir dire, the same French term used for the questioning of prospective jurors at selection, meaning to speak the truth. But the exception is deliberately narrow, and the Supreme Judicial Court has described this territory as fraught with potential error. A deliberating juror may be removed only for a reason personal to that juror: illness, an outside influence, a personal incapacity, and never for the juror's position on the merits or for friction with the other 11. The merits belong to the jury. Only the person belongs to the court. Now, hold the note against that rule and watch the two readings that fought over it in the Plymouth courtroom. The defense's reading: the note reports a juror who acknowledges doubt and refuses to apply it. That is not a merits position. That is a juror declining to apply the legal standard at all, a personal incapacity under the oath, and under Raunchy, the court must inquire and, if confirmed, remove. The Commonwealth's reading: the note reports a disagreement about how to weigh the evidence, and disagreement about the weight of evidence is not a refusal of the law. It is deliberation itself, the exact thing the black box protects. The prosecutor put it in one sentence: what we have here is a note that indicates a disagreement about how to weigh the evidence, and that's deliberation. Judge Sullivan's resolution of that fight is the analytical center of this article, because he did not choose between the two readings by probing the juror. He chose by parsing the note. The instruction on reasonable doubt that the Supreme Judicial Court recommends, the instruction both sides had agreed to, the instruction he had given, says that reasonable doubt does not mean proof beyond all possible doubt. Now read the note again through that lens. A juror who acknowledges doubt but refuses to apply it may be a juror refusing the law, or maybe a juror who simply holds a different, more demanding idea of what doubt requires, an idea the instruction itself anticipates and argues against. The note, read strictly and carefully, does not tell the court which of those two jurors wrote it. And so, the judge ruled, the note does not indicate that this is a person who has refused to follow the law. Text over intrusion. The ambiguity of the note became the reason not to investigate it. There was a second, quieter trap underneath, and the hearing surfaced it. The day before, after the note arrived, the judge had brought in every juror individually, including the one at issue, and asked each whether they could follow his instructions. Every juror, including that one, said yes. Which meant that removing the juror now required the judge to find that the juror had looked him in the eye and lied under oath. And the judge said explicitly that the record showed no such thing. The note does not indicate that this juror lied. There is no indication that the juror is intentionally trying to mislead the court. The defense argued the conclusion was unavoidable. If the note is true and the voir dire answer is true, one of them is false. And a juror who swore falsely to stay on a jury is a juror who must go. The judge's answer, in effect, the law does not require him to build that syllogism on an ambiguous note, and building it is precisely the invasion the cases forbid. At myaudiobooks.ai, you can listen to this story and thousands of others that explore the hidden science and mechanics behind the headlines. So, the court did the one thing the books clearly allow. It re-instructed the panel as a whole, without singling anyone out, in language aimed at the note without naming it. It is your duty as jurors to accept the law as I stated it to you, the judge told them. You should consider all of my instructions as a whole. You must follow the law as I give it to you, whether you agree with it or not. The law applies to everyone. And he sent them back. The defense was not done, because the defense had a second jurisdiction in reserve. In the federal system, a rule of criminal procedure allows a judge to excuse a deliberating juror for good cause and continue with 11, or seat an alternate. And the federal case the defense cited, United States versus Sepulveda from the First Circuit in 1993, holds that a juror's refusal to follow the law can be that good cause, while warning of the care required before finding it. The Sepulveda argument carries the oldest question about juries inside it: nullification, the jury's raw power to acquit for any reason, including reasons the law does not permit. The power is real, the cases say. It cannot be punished. But the duty runs the other way. Jurors swear to apply the law as given, and a juror who announces an intent not to is breaking the oath, even while exercising the power. The Massachusetts rule, as argued that day, is more protective of the black box than the federal one, and the judge was sitting in a Massachusetts court applying Massachusetts law, and the federal path was at most a preserved argument for another day. While all of this unfolded in Plymouth, the case was simultaneously being argued in front of a single justice of the Supreme Judicial Court on an emergency petition filed to stop the mistrial before it happened. The mechanism has two names worth knowing. The first is the court's extraordinary superintendent's power under General Laws Chapter 211, Section 3, the authority of the state's highest court to step into any lower court when an error cannot be corrected by ordinary appeal, a power used sparingly precisely because it bypasses the ordinary process. The second is mandamus, an order from a higher court commanding a lower court to perform a duty so clear that no discretion exists. And mandamus has an iron requirement that the whole petition broke against. It compels duties, never judgment calls. The defense's own framing at the emergency hearing, captured in the recording-derived transcript, concedes the shape of the problem in one breath. "I don't think there's a lot of doubt that this was error," counsel said. "The question is, under what authority, if any, can the SJC intervene? Under Section 211.3, and as a complaint for mandamus." Error, even conceded error, is not enough. Superintendence requires irreparability, harm that ordinary appeal can never fix. And a mistrial, paradoxically, supplies its own remedy in the form of a new trial. Mandamus requires a clear duty, and the decision whether to probe a deliberating juror is the most discretionary act in trial law. The single justice denied the petition. The temporary stay that had paused the trial was lifted. The emergency door closed as quietly as it had opened. Back in Plymouth, the end came fast. The jury sent its final note. "It is with a heavy heart that we report we are unable to come to a unanimous decision and will not be able to." The defense made one last argument for one more sendback on the sequencing preserved from the first deadlock. Only one formal re-instruction had been given. The law allowed another. It also made a quieter, longer odds request with enormous implications: a poll of the jury for a partial verdict. Because if 12 jurors had unanimously agreed to acquit on any charge or any theory before the deadlock hardened, then double jeopardy would bar re-prosecution of that charge forever. And the poll would have been the only way to know. The poll never happened. The rules do not require a judge to seek a partial verdict before declaring a mistrial, and the judge declared it. The reason a retrial is even possible after all this is a doctrine with a name from the Double Jeopardy Clause itself: manifest necessity. The rule that when a jury genuinely cannot reach a verdict, the necessity of ending the trial is manifest, and re-prosecution does not offend the Constitution's promise that no person shall be twice put in jeopardy for the same offense.
The doctrine is the system's pressure valve. Deadlock cannot mean permanent immunity, or every stubborn trial would end the matter. But the valve has a catch that the defense's preserved arguments were aimed at. Manifest necessity covers a jury that deadlocks on its own. It may not cover a deadlock the court manufactured or rushed, a mistrial declared too quickly, or after handling that pushed the jury apart. That is why the send-back sequencing, the re-instruction choices, and the refusal to inquire all matter beyond the day. Each is now a line in the record that the retrial's double jeopardy argument will be built from, and the September 29th hearing is where the building starts. The court declares a mistrial. Bail orders continued. The case was set for September 29, 2026, for status, trial assignment, and argument on the defense's motion for a required finding of not guilty, the Rule 25 motion, which asks the judge to find that the evidence was legally insufficient rather than merely unconvincing to 11 people, a distinction that decides whether the retrial happens at all. The strongest case against this article's framing, the dead-end framing, deserves to be stated at full strength, because it might be right. The rules are the protection. Every alternative the defense proposed creates a worse world than the mistrial did. A judge empowered to interrogate a juror on the strength of an ambiguous note is a judge empowered to shape verdicts. Anytime a jury is one vote from acquitting, a prosecutor's friend could produce a note about a juror who will not follow the law, and the inquiry that follows would do the work the evidence could not. A judge who removes a holdout because 11 others describe her reasoning badly has appointed the 11 as the measure of the 12th's lawful thought. A high court that micromanages deliberations by emergency petition converts every deadlock into an appeal. The mistrial is not the system failing. It is the system declining to let anyone, judge, prosecutor, or court above, force 12 minds into one. Coercion was avoided. Deliberation was protected. The retrial stands ready on the same evidence. The design did not produce a dead end. It produced the only lawful exit. And the discomfort of that exit is the purchase price of the black box. And the strongest case for the dead end framing is the one the defense was left holding. If the note meant what it said, then a juror sat through 5 weeks of evidence, swore to follow the law, and declined to. And every institution that touched the problem agreed that no one was permitted to find out. Three findings would disprove the dead end reading or confirm it going forward. First, if the Supreme Judicial Court or the Appeals Court, reviewing this case or another like it, approves targeted inquiry on facts like these, an ambiguous note plus a holdout, then Judge Sullivan's textual restraint becomes the outlier rather than the standard. Second, if the retrial now scheduled produces a clean verdict without procedural incident, the dead end shrinks to a one-trial anomaly in an unusually hard case, and the system absorbs it. Third, if the Rule 25 motion succeeds on any count on September 29th, if the court finds the evidence legally insufficient, then the procedural saga is eclipsed by an evidentiary judgment, and the retrial question and the jury question collapse into a simpler one that the first article asked: whether the Commonwealth's proof was ever enough for any jury. It is worth saying one final time what these two articles have not claimed. They have not claimed Lindsay Clancy was responsible or not responsible. There was no verdict, and the retrial has not happened. They have not claimed the holdout juror was right, wrong, steadfast, or nullifying. The public record contains a note, a characterization of a note, and a judge's careful reading of both, and nothing more. They have not claimed Judge Sullivan erred. The emergency petition said error, the defense said duty, the Commonwealth said discretion, and the single justice declined to choose. And this article reports that stalemate, rather than settling it. And they have not claimed the system is broken or sound, only that on September 4th, 2026, in Plymouth, Massachusetts, every actor in a murder trial followed the rules of their office. And the rules, working perfectly, produced an ending nobody wanted and nobody could lawfully prevent. The jury system is the one institution in American law that is deliberately built to be unreachable, a room the government cannot enter, wired against every tool it might use to force an answer. Most days, that design is invisible, because most juries agree. The first Clancy trial found the edge of the design, the place where the room's protection and the room's secrecy are the same wall, where a single mind's refusal, if refusal it was, can hold the entire apparatus of the state at bay, and where the law's only answer is to start over and hope the next 12 minds find a way to win. The 11th juror went home without a name in the record, without a finding, without a verdict. The case goes back on the calendar on September 29th. And the question the jury was asked in the first article waits, unanswered, for the next 12 people who will be asked it. At myaudiobooks.ai, you can create fiction, nonfiction, and turn your documents into audio, all stored in one place with a single subscription. Plus, get instant access to thousands of audiobooks and deep dive investigations. Learn more today at myaudiobooks.ai. This concludes the audiobook narration. Thank you for listening.